The Taliban Islami U.S. drone strike targeting a suspected suicide bomber in Kabul. The group says the attack resulted in the death of 7 Afghan civilians. Israeli bulldozers backed by troops destroy a Palestinian house in East Al-Quds in the occupied West Bank. Australia's New South Wales reports another record one-day rise in new COVID-19 cases while the country is struggling to battle the Delta variant. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zanjafik. Good to have you with us. Starting with Afghanistan, the Taliban slamming the U.S. for a drone strike against the suspected Daesh terrorists in Kabul. They say the attack resulted in civilian casualties. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid confirmed 7 deaths from the air raid. He called Washington's action unlawful, adding that the U.S. should have informed the Taliban before launching such an attack. American officials had earlier announced that they were investigating the possibility of civilian casualties in the Sunday strike. Meanwhile, multiple rockets were fired at the Kabul International Airport earlier today. They were intercepted by a missile defense system. Now, all this happening is the U.S. is racing against time to complete its pull out of Afghanistan. In a briefing, President Biden said that the operations are going on uninterrupted at the Kabul airport. I talked to journalist and political analyst Brian Berletic, and he says that a chaos in Afghanistan is the result of 20 years of U.S. military presence there.
This is 20 years of U.S. foreign policy in Afghanistan unraveling before everyone's eyes. They're claiming that they're leaving Afghanistan because they have accomplished their mission of preventing the country from being used as a safe haven for terrorism, and at the same time, they're claiming ISIS or Daesh is attacking them as they're withdrawing, so obviously that's not true. They are conducting these over-the-horizon drone strikes that are most likely flying out of either Qatar or the United Arab Emirates. Both of these countries have been identified by the U.S. as state sponsors of terrorism, including of Daesh or ISIS. So everything we're seeing now in Afghanistan, it looks chaotic because this is 20 years of lies unraveling, and the U.S. cannot cover up what they've done there any longer.
Well, Tehran has stressed that the only way to bring peace and stability to Afghanistan is forming an inclusive government. Foreign Ministry spokesman says that Afghanistan's next government has to include all ethnic groups and help secure their rights. Said Khatibzadeh says the Taliban are part of the Afghan future, but he added that Iran will be waiting for the formation of the new Afghan government before making decisions about bilateral ties. The spokesman added that Iran supports genuine intra-Afghan talks in order to set the stage for the people there to decide their own fate without any foreign interference. He said that Tehran welcomes any initiative for regional peace and is prepared to hold another round of talks on Afghanistan. Israeli forces have yet demolished another Palestinian house in the occupied territory. Bulldozers, backed by forces, destroyed a house in Jabal Makaber village in East Al-Quds. This is the latest in a series of destructions carried out by Israeli forces in the occupied territories recently. Israel demolishes Palestinian homes and structures on a regular basis, citing pretexts, including a lack of construction permit. Palestinians and rights groups say that the operations are aimed at grabbing more land for Israeli settlement expansion. Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have lashed out at President Mahmoud Abbas for a meeting with Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz. Hamas described the move as a stab in the Palestinians' back, saying that Abbas has abandoned national values. The resistance movement called for a united front against such a humiliating behavior. Another group, the Islamic Jihad movement, also slammed the meeting, saying that a Palestinian president is boosting ties with the enemy. Abbas and Gantz met on Sunday in the West Bank city of Ramallah. The two discussed a number of issues, including security and economic situation in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. In the meantime, Israeli forces have violently clashed with Palestinians protesting near the so-called buffer zone in the Gaza Strip against years of Israeli siege of their territory. Some 20 Palestinians injured after the regime forces attacked. Protesters were venting their anger by burning tires and chanting anti-Israel slogans. Some of the protesters threw stones and Molotov cocktails at the forces. Demonstrators said that they would continue their protests until the regime lifted its crippling blockade of Gaza.
The Israeli regime must lift the siege, and it must know very well that the rebellious youth are ready to crush its soldiers, crush the settlers, and confuse them at night. We will not allow our children to starve to death. These activities will continue until the siege on our people is lifted.
At least 11 Palestinians were injured in similar protests on Saturday when Israeli forces resorted to live fire and tear gas. Gaza has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. The siege and several wars have destroyed the economy there. In 2018, people in Gaza launched a protest movement demanding an end to Israel's blockade and the right for Palestinians to return to the land they were forcibly expelled from after the creation of Israel in 1948. Our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, says that Israeli atrocities continue amid international silence, particularly by a number of regional Arab states.
What's really sad for Palestinians in Gaza is that Egypt is also helping the Israeli regime with this blockade by imposing a proxy blockade against the enclave. And as you mentioned, the peaceful protests during 2018 started on March 30th. 2018, when Palestinians launched the Great March of Return. Israeli forces used excessive force against the peaceful protesters, killed nearly 300 protesters, mainly children. Hundreds more suffered permanent disabilities due to Israel's use of internationally banned weapons against the protesters. So the Israeli regime has been doing this for many years, and many here believe that This illegal regime has been emboldened by the fact that Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region, have normalized their ties with Tel Aviv, and they believe that such moves by countries, mainly the United Arab Emirates, have given Tel Aviv the green light to kill and maim Palestinians and further violate their rights.
The Australian state of New South Wales has witnessed another day of record COVID cases. They registered nearly 1,300 infections in one day. That's the third straight day in the state's cases, surpassing 1,200. It also had four more fatalities on Monday. The spike in cases continues despite more than 2 months of lockdown imposed after a Delta-driven outbreak in June. State authorities warning that intensive care units will hit a peak in October. But they say that the health system is ready to cope with the situation. Coronavirus cases also keep rising in the state of Victoria, where 73 new infections were reported yesterday. Authorities there saying they will extend the lockdown to at least one more week. Thousands of people have staged rallies in Washington, D.C. and several other cities across the United States. Demonstrators demanded protections for voting rights and protested laws in several Republican-led states that critics say will make it harder for the minorities to vote.
Thousands of activists gathered nationwide to commemorate the 58th anniversary of Martin Luther King's Voting Equality March in Washington on Saturday. They protested against curbs to voting access in some Republican-led states that rights groups say disproportionately affect people of color. Many activists view the fight over voting rules as the civil rights issue of the era. In Washington, about 20,000 marchers held Black Lives Matter flags and signs and called on Congress to bolster voter rights. Other rallies were planned in Phoenix, Miami, and several other U.S. cities. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonprofit public policy institute, for this year, at least 18 states have adopted a total of 30 restrictive election laws, with dozens of others under consideration. Those laws range from a requirement to have a fixed address in order to register the vote to a ban on the drive-through voting that was popular in some states last year amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The organizers of Saturday's protests denounced the legislation as racist, anti-democratic voter suppression laws and demanded that the U.S. Congress pass legislation to block such voting restrictions. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden admitted that the recent push in Republican-controlled states to restrict voting access is in contrast with fair and free elections.
There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote in fair and free elections.
The Democratic-controlled House of Representatives has passed two draft laws to limit voting restrictions. But in the closely divided Senate, Republicans have promised to block voting rights legislation. This is a sign of polarization in the U.S. Congress.
Well, I think you have to look at it in the context of the United States political sphere. I don't think voting or our system in the United States is particularly democratic from the very onset. You have to keep in mind that when the United States Constitution was first written, first ratified, you know, only white male property owners were able to vote or have any say in public discourse. And unfortunately, not too much has changed. You know, maybe there's a little bit more people of color, maybe there's a little bit more women, but the property owning part is largely still in effect, because you have the average income of elected officials at the federal level is so high. I don't think most people in the United States feel represented by their elected officials. I don't think they think our country is going in the right direction.
The March on for Voting Rights protests come amid state-level curbs to voting access. Organizers denounce what they brand as racist, anti-democratic voter suppression laws that disproportionately affect people of color. African Americans see it yet as another way that blacks have been marginalized by the whites in the U.S.
American society is plagued with racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group, as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. On Saturday, thousands of people demonstrated in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, and in several cities across the country to demand voting rights protection.
Our country is backsliding to the unconscionable days of Jim Crow. And some of our senators are saying, well, we can't overcome the filibuster. Then I say to you today, get rid of the filibuster. That is the monument to slavery we must dismantle. That is the monument to white supremacy we must tear down.
I march because I'm tired of elected officials putting themselves first. To be honest, I am disgusted by the behavior of many of our leaders. In this country, it's easier to register to own a gun than it is to register to vote. Think about that. If you are a congressperson protecting firearms, why won't you protect the right to vote? That is completely unacceptable. I march because I want change, not just for me, but for everyone who comes next.
While some marchers carried posters supporting the end of the filibuster, others chanted about police violence toward black people, workers' rights, the Afghanistan withdrawal, and minimum wage. This is a clear message that voting rights were not the only issue in people's minds.
Now let's move on. The World Health Organization is warning about another 236,000 COVID-19 related deaths in Europe by the 1st of December.
Several countries are starting to observe an increased burden on hospitals and more deaths. Last week, there was an 11% increase in the number of deaths in the region, with one reliable projection expecting 236,000 deaths in Europe by December 1st.
The WHO's Europe director says the 33 states in Europe have registered a death rate of over 10% in the past 2 weeks. Hans Kluge described the high transmission rates across the continent as deeply worrying. He attributed the rise in infections on the more contagious Delta variant, the easing of restrictions, and a surge in summer travel. Kluge noted that even though around half of Europe's population is fully inoculated, vaccination uptake in the region has slowed down. He said the decline in vaccination is of serious concern, while urging countries to increase production and share vaccines. The International Atomic Energy Agency is reporting that North Korea appears to have resumed operation of a plutonium-producing reactor at Yongbyon Nuclear Complex. In its annual report, the UN agency said that there have been indications consistent with the operation of the reactor. The report says that the reactor appeared to have been inactive from December 2018 till the beginning of July this year. North Korea has been under multiple rounds of sanctions by the United Nations and the U.S. over its nuclear and missile programs. Pyongyang says the programs are aimed at countering nuclear threats from the U.S. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, says that North Korea had offered to dismantle the Yongbyon nuclear complex, but it was turned down by the U.S.
When we look at this, we need to go back to January and February of 2019. That's the last time there were any negotiations between North Korea and the U.S. with the summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump. And at that time, just prior to that, as you mentioned, North Korea had stopped operation of the Yongbyon facility. But that meeting, that summit between Trump and Kim really failed to make any progress. It was cut short suddenly with Kim returning to North Korea without a deal, and reports suggesting that he had offered the U.S. to dismantle the Yongbyon facilities, but was turned down. So it's really not surprising that we would see this reconstituted and activity at that at that facility now.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Did women also play a role in the event of Ashura? February 8, 2010. Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, did not have to endure the psychological pains that Zainab al-Kubra went through. On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra watched many of her dear ones go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali, Abbas, Ali Akbar, Qasim, her children, and other dear ones go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains, the invasion of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, "Oh my Lord, save me." On the day of Ashura, she said, "Oh God, accept this from us." While the shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes, tells God, "Oh God, accept this sacrifice from us." When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, "I did not see anything but beauty."
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum.
أنا لا تشام
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا تشام
أنا لا
All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainab al-Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God. See how different this position, this patience, and this love of justice and truth are compared to Asiya's position described in the Holy Quran. This shows the greatness of Zainab's position. This is the nature of actions that are carried out for the sake of God. Therefore, Zainab's actions are currently a model, and her name and achievements will remain until the end of time. The permanence of Islam and the divine path and continuation of this path by God's servants are based on what Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam and Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, did. That is to say, as a result of the great patience, resistance, and endurance of hardships, you see that religious values have gained a lot of ground in the modern world. All these human values, which are consistent with human nature in different schools of thoughts, are rooted in religious values. These values have been promoted by religion. That is the nature of efforts for a divine cause.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Thursday, the Afghan capital Kabul became the scene of carnage. Scores of people were killed after two bombs exploded in the crowd outside the international Kabul airport. The Pentagon, however, stated there was only one bomb attack. Over a dozen U.S. troops were confirmed to have been killed in the attack. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility. The blast came as hundreds of people were rushing to leave the Afghan capital prior to the August 31st deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden to fully withdraw troops from the country. Intelligence reports had warned about the possibility of attacks on the airport by an offshoot of the Daesh terrorist group, which has fought against both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The U.S. president vowed revenge on the perpetrators, saying the evacuation efforts will continue regardless.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Some, however, are questioning why the U.S. chose to withdraw from this Central Asian country at this point, and if it can continue its operations in Afghanistan without having a military base there.
I think that there are a couple of reasons. First of all, they might not have thought it was important. Secondly, they were probably preoccupied with getting out. Thirdly, I'm not sure that their intelligence is as good as they say. And I think that from their point of view, they had degraded Al-Qaeda to the point that they were satisfied with. They were not focused on Afghanistan.
The outcome of the United States' longest war has also raised questions about the success of foreign military presence in the country. More than 111,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept to power on August 15th. The Taliban had allowed U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31st deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out the Al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. He has noted that the aim of the war has never been nation-building, a statement in contrast to what U.S. officials used to say when the war began.
But the fundamental issue is that in many, many cases, it's not only Afghanistan, it's been Syria, it's been Iraq, it has been countries in Africa. We've intervened in South America. Basically, without any willingness on the United States part to recognize the sovereignty of other countries. So unless we begin to deal with that, I don't think we're going to be particularly effective in dealing with groups that we conceive to be terrorists.
Over the past 20 years, the U.S. and its NATO allies maintained a military presence in Afghanistan with the stated aim of fighting terrorists. The recent incident at the Kabul airport was a clear indication that the mission was not accomplished.
The U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has arrived in Vietnam as she continues the tour of Southeast Asia in an attempt to co-opt countries against China. Speaking in Hanoi on Wednesday, Harris said that there was a need to increase pressure on Beijing over its maritime claims in the South China Sea. She offered Vietnamese President's support to counter Beijing in the South China Sea. We need to find ways to raise the pressure on Beijing to abide by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea and to challenge its bullying and excessive maritime claims. Speaking in Singapore one day earlier, Harris had said that Beijing's use of what she called scare tactics in the South China Sea continued to undermine what she described as a rules-based order and threatened the sovereignty of other regional nations. Laying out the U.S. administration's foreign policy goals, Harris reiterated that Washington had enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific region and aimed to counter Beijing's aggressive advances, as well as to maintain freedom of navigation. Harris sought to assure America's Southeast Asian allies that growing U.S.-China tensions would not force nations that have strong ties with both countries to choose one side of the political equation. She said, however, that Washington would take the side of its allies in all of their territorial disputes with China.
Our vision includes freedom of navigation, which is vital to us all. The livelihood of millions of people depend on the billions of dollars in trade that flow through these sea lanes each day. And yet, in the South China Sea, we know that Beijing continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea.
Well, we know that the United States has little to no regard for international law and regulations. As a matter of fact, a couple months ago, there was an article published about the United States Coast Guard being in the, I believe it was Mediterranean. Now, mind you, why would the Coast Guard of the United States be in international waters unless the United States has no desire to keep international regulations and to follow international procedure?
In response to Harris's remarks, Chinese state media decried the U.S. vice president, accusing her of interfering in regional affairs by seeking to divide China and Southeast Asian nations to prevent Beijing's economic growth. China's state-run China Daily said in an editorial that while pointing a finger at China and accusing it of coercion and intimidation, Harris willfully ignored her own hypocrisy in attempting to coerce and intimidate regional countries to join Washington in a scheme to contain China. Seems that the United States' only commitment to Southeast Asia is its dedicated efforts to drive a wedge between the Southeast Asian nations and China. Meanwhile, China has accused Washington of bullying and hegemonic behavior. China's foreign ministry said that Afghanistan was one of the many examples defining what the U.S.'s so-called world order truly meant for nations.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce, and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
The U.S. sees its rivalry with China as the biggest geopolitical test of the century. Southeast Asia has seen a series of high-profile visits by top U.S. administration officials, including the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who visited Hanoi in late July. The visits have escalated tensions between the U.S. and China, which were already high due to a range of issues ranging from cybersecurity to human rights abuses.
The United States wants to destabilize China. China is an upcoming economic superpower. Its economy in some places has already surpassed the United States. China has a growing, the most large population in the world. It is sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars worth of important resources for modern technology. It's beginning to take a lead in the space race.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year and contains huge gas fields and rich fishing grounds. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and since 2014 has built artificial islands and reefs and installed military bases on them.
The Israeli regime is a sworn enemy of regional power Iran, and it makes no secret of its animosity towards the Islamic Republic, which is leading a regional front against the occupying force. The regime has assassinated several top Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran and is widely believed to have carried out sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, which operate under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Israel has recently escalated its anti-Iran rhetoric. This week, the regime renewed military threats against the Islamic Republic. The Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, issued a new threat against Iran's nuclear facilities. Gantz said Israel has the means to act alone and would not hesitate to strike Iran. He made the threat after once again accusing Tehran of orchestrating a recent drone attack on an Israeli-linked oil tanker last month. The Mercer Street was sailing in the sea off Oman on July 29th when it was struck. Iran has denied any involvement in that attack, but Tel Aviv is apparently using the naval incident as a pretext to rally its regional and Western allies against Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who is currently in the United States, is also trying to persuade the Americans to avoid diplomacy with Iran. The Israeli premier insisted that clandestine operations against Iran's nuclear program would not stop.
It's meant to create tension, and it is meant to try to push the Biden administration into disavowing negotiations with Iran. I'm quite sure that those negotiations will go on, even if, discreetly, even if there is a public avowal to support Israeli security.
Bennett seems to be on a mission in the U.S., pushing U.S. President Joe Biden to get tougher on Iran. Soon after arrival in the U.S., Bennett doubled down on his threats against Iran. Will that affect America's stance? The U.S. president has already refused to lift any of the sanctions that his predecessor imposed on Iran after unilaterally leaving the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Biden was a vociferous critic of Donald Trump's Iran policy, but after several months into his presidency, he is still refusing to change America's course. Biden's stance has seriously undermined the prospect of a return to the 2015 nuclear deal, as Iran insists that the U.S. sanctions must be removed before the deal is restored. Meanwhile, the Iranians have made it clear that any attack on Iran would be met with ultimate force. Just recently, the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warned that a mistake on the part of the regime would lead to its collapse. Major General Hossein Salami said the stage has been set for Israel's collapse in any future war.
It would defend itself with all of the military might it can muster. And in the case of Iran, that's quite a pit. And that is, again, why I say it is obvious to me, it should be obvious to most observers, that the United States does not want to get drawn into that type of a situation. I do believe that Israel fully understands that any attack against Iran would be a serious blowback to itself.
The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for instability in the region and beyond.
Witnesses the developments in Afghanistan following the chaos that ensued from the abrupt U.S. withdrawal from the country, questions are being raised about Washington's war on Afghanistan and its outcome. The Taliban swept through the country at a lightning speed and managed to take control of the capital, Kabul, in less than 2 weeks. Even the Pentagon officials expressed wonder at the rate at which provincial capitals across Afghanistan fell to the militants, as the U.S. intelligence services had estimated the Afghan capital would be isolated within 30 days and overtaken 2 months after. The harrowing scenes of chaos at the Kabul airport amid the evacuation of Western citizens and troops also drew criticism against how the foreign forces pulled out of the Central Asian country. Some observers are drawing parallels between the events in Afghanistan and the U.S. retreat from Vietnam Saigon after two decades of mindless violence in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The scenes were also reminiscent of Israel's humiliating defeat in southern Lebanon in the year 2000.
Yes, I think it's a valid comparison, because both humiliating withdrawals came as a result of Western powers intervening militarily in states where they were not welcome. And they will continue to meddle militarily in the country. So I think one could say that national sovereignty and territorial integrity is not guaranteed for most of the countries of the world until finally the U.S. empire is brought down.
What do these historical events say about the U.S. and its ally Israel's influence in the West and Central Asia? The United States invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks in New York with the stated aim of fighting terrorism. It removed the Taliban from power and installed a pro-Western government in the country. Washington has also been training Afghan security forces over the years, providing more than $80 billion worth of funds to build up the Central Asian country's 300,000-strong army. It has also trained 22,000 commandos and special forces in Afghanistan to defend against security threats. However, the number of attacks in Afghanistan saw a sharp growth since Western troops were deployed to the country. Furthermore, the costly training of the soldiers turned out pointless as they quickly surrendered to the Taliban amid the militants' incursion.
The fact that the U.S. is losing around the world and that Israel is losing its grip in the Middle East is due to the fact that people are resisting in the countries of the world, and especially in the Middle East.
The drawdown of the U.S. forces from West and Central Asia can also have implications for Israel, Washington's closest ally in the region.
It's true that Israel's power relies 100% on the power of the U.S. empire. And if the U.S. empire continue, if people continue to resist successfully, and if the U.S. continues to weaken, then Israel's leaders might think about turning a new page. They might think about sharing the land with the Palestinian people, including all the refugees from around the world.
The events in Afghanistan in the past 2 weeks are going to be remembered in history books as yet another example of Western powers' failures after intervening in the affairs of countries where they are not welcome. The question is whether those actors will learn the lessons or if history will keep repeating itself.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr al-Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini. Some discipline and secrets of takbirs and the eradication of hands. And unless you will be subordinate to Allah, you won't be Muslim. And as far as you are selfish, you are within the circle of dualism. And unless you become the absolute annihilated, you cannot say, say, lo, my worship and my sacrifice and my living and my dying are for Allah. Lord of the worlds. Thus, if you find yourself unable for such task, never stand in the first row of the people of the knowledgeable, and don't make fun of yourself before the nobles.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another saying of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini, in one of his speeches, he mentions that Islam accepts material things that are subservient to spiritualities. In another speech, he mentions that Islam provides inner training as well as preserve material welfare. Now, this is very important. Generally, when we talk about Islam, when it is said to follow the Quran or the teachings of Islam, generally people think that we should not follow what has been put for us in this material world, and maybe leaving the material welfare, or Islam does not accept the material things. It's against this material world. Whereas Imam Khomeini is pointing a very important thing. He is pointing out a very important thing, and he says that Islam accepts material things that are subservient to the spiritualities. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. This material world in which we are living at this time, this mortal or the natural world in which we are, from our body to everything else you see in this world, these are subservient to the soul so that we can get to the perfection, we can achieve perfection. If someone wants to achieve a perfection in his life, if he uses these material things as a subservient to spiritualities, yes, he will get that perfection. And the concept of halal and haram, we can also mention this as well, that the logic behind the things that are halal and haram, for example, that we have is also the same thing, because the things that are halal in this world, in this material world, the welfare that we have in this material world from the material things, that is because they are subservient to spirituality. And if they're against the spirituality, then that thing has been made haram.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at America's disastrous legacy in Afghanistan and the consequences of 20-year-long U.S. military adventurism that plunged the war-ravaged country into unimaginable chaos. And we shall discuss how the U.S. longest war spawned terrorism, poverty, corruption, nepotism, warlordism, and human rights abuses in Afghanistan.
After splurging trillions of dollars to decimate the Taliban, causing death, destruction, and displacement, as well as lying to American taxpayers about a disastrous war, U.S. President Joe Biden finally pulled the plug on the 20-year-long adventure, but not before the country plunged into chaos. There are several things that were wrong for the U.S. that allies in Afghanistan, from failed strategy, unrealistic goals, systematic lying, hegemonic ambitions, and failure to win the hearts and minds of people. Afghanistan has for a reason been the graveyard of empires.
Americans invaded Afghanistan in 2001, following the devastating events of 9/11, to annihilate the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. On the paper, the goal was to capture Osama bin Laden, the former CIA ally and the alleged mastermind of 9/11 attacks. But in reality, then US President George Bush and his hawkish Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld wanted full-scale war. They saw it as an opportunity to militarily occupy the mineral-rich country lying at the crossroads of Central Asia and South Asia.
I think the biggest problem was that we did not have strategic focus at the beginning of this conflict. We had known since 1996 that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was a threat to the United States and its allies. And yet from 1996 to 2001, we did not effectively deal with this threat. Even after two U.S. embassies were bombed in Africa, a U.S. naval vessel was bombed in a Yemeni port, and other attacks were made by Al-Qaeda on U.S. interests. And then when 9/11 occurred, the terrorist attacks on the United States in September 11, 2001, we didn't have a plan other than revenge. And revenge is never a plan. Revenge is never a strategy. We, instead of seeking to come up with the best solution to the problem of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, we wanted blood. We wanted bodies. We wanted revenge. Our politicians needed to be able to look at the American people and say, we have killed people. We have punished people for the crimes that were perpetrated against us. And anytime you start a war with that mindset, it's not going to go well, because you will get distracted. You will get, you will lose track of what you're doing. And this is what happened in Afghanistan.
For the past 20 years, Americans splurged trillions of dollars and dispatched Black Hawks loaded with special commandos to Afghanistan. Contrary to what you hear, it was not done for nation building or promoting peace and democracy. The goal was to consolidate the military control over the landlocked country and make it subservient to the US. But the one thing successive regimes in Washington seemed to disregard was history. From the British in 1839 to the Americans in 2021, foreign powers have always faced defeat and disgrace in the strategically located country. What Americans faced, though, will count as the worst strategic and military debacle of the last century. The way Taliban's much smaller ragtag army pummeled the world's most powerful military carries important lessons. It also bears testimony to America's inglorious legacy of humiliation, surrender, and defeat in Afghanistan.
The dramatic turn of events in the wake of Taliban's takeover of Kabul last week quite clearly demonstrate the failed U.S. foreign policy gambles and lessons unlearned from such debacles in the past. But the decline and fall in Afghanistan did not unfold just last week. Every year, for the past two decades, desperate and hopeless Afghans have been fleeing their troubled homeland amid rising violence, insecurity, poverty, lawlessness, and corruption. Americans not only failed to keep their promise of building the institutions of governance in Afghanistan, but they also spawned corruption, patronized warlords, emboldened militant groups, and carried out horrendous war crimes.
Neoconservative Americans and their NATO allies, who launched the war in Afghanistan and spent years defending it, are now busy playing blame games over last week's fiasco. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg blamed the Afghan government for Taliban's stunning takeover. Former UK Premier Tony Blair slammed Joe Biden for the imbecile pullout. Former US President Donald Trump fired salvos at both Biden and runaway Afghan President Ashraf Ghani.
Biden's botched exit in Afghanistan is the most astonishing display of gross incompetence by a nation's leader. I've never been a big fan of Ghani. I always said he was a total crook. I've said it for years.
Biden and his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, in turn, washed their hands off the mess. What they refuse to acknowledge is that the debacle has been the result of their own missteps in the war-ravaged country. 20 years down the line, 90% of people in Afghanistan live below poverty line. National economy remains heavily dependent on foreign aid. The country continues to produce third highest number of refugees. There are also around 4 million internally displaced people. Institutions of governance and rule of law lie in shambles. A sizable population is addicted to opium, and around 90% of its supply continues to flow from Afghanistan. Afghanistan remains one of the worst performing countries on the Quality of Life Index. And more importantly, no Afghan sleeps in peace at night. That is the legacy of America's 20-year war in Afghanistan.
20 years on, has the U.S. military occupation in Afghanistan brought peace and security? Has it stemmed the seamless exodus of Afghans? Have the incidents of violence and civilian casualties dropped? The answer is a resounding no. American presence all these years turned the country into a breeding ground for terrorism and organized crime, most of which was aided and abetted by Americans themselves. America will be remembered in Afghanistan for airstrikes, drone strikes, night raids, drug trafficking, corruption, and regional instability.
The stated objective of America's military intervention in Afghanistan in 2001 was to dismantle the sanctuaries of Taliban and Al-Qaeda. After the mission was accomplished, the foreign invaders refused to quit. That effectively paved the way for Taliban's resurgence, which came in the backdrop of horrific war crimes by the US and NATO forces. One of the earliest heart-rending tragedies came in August 2008 when 91 innocent civilians, including 60 children and 16 women, were killed in the U.S. bombing of a small hamlet in western Herat province. The perpetrators got away with it. In 2015, around 40 people were killed in a U.S. airstrike that targeted a hospital in northern Kunduz province. They again got away with it. In between these two massacres, many other mass murders took place. The pandemic of impunity continued even as poor civilians vanished into thin air. Americans had the license to kill. Night raids also came to represent the most terrifying tactics of war in Afghanistan, like the incident in southeastern Paktia province in 2010, where 5 civilians, including 2 pregnant women, were killed. Incidents like these made Afghans feel unsafe in their own homes. Custodial torture became another problematic part of American legacy in Afghanistan, as the International Criminal Court highlighted in its report in 2017. Americans also patronized and sponsored infamous warlords, drug traffickers, and military contractors in the country, which only bred widespread distrust. Thus, the debacle of the U.S. and the comeback of the Taliban did not happen overnight.
As U.S. Chinook helicopters rushed to evacuate American diplomats from the U.S. embassy in Kabul last week, hours after Taliban laid siege to the city, it was a deja vu moment for many. almost 46 years ago, the U.S. had airlifted its military and diplomatic figures out of Vietnam after Saigon fell